from the Crypt.
What is up, freaks? Welcome back to Tales from the Crypt. It's your boy, Marty Bent. We have a very interesting podcast set up here. We have a group here. I'm sitting with Tom Garambone, who you freaks know, from co-founder of Tetris Capital. He's been on the pod before. It's a nice two-part conversation you guys can go check out. Also have Matt Odell in here for this conversation as well.
Cheers, freaks.
And a very special guest, a very prominent Bitcoin economist, John Dilley. John, welcome.
Hey, and my company's Mempool, by the way.
And from Mempool.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we've been shooting the shit for like a half an hour. Tom was a little late.
Thanks,
had to wait
Tom
for him.
Apologies.
I want to jump in. We're using the 21 computer box as a mic stand, and you told it a very interesting story.
Dude, it's going to be like that's going to be a valuable antique one day.
Yeah.
Like you're going to have it on your shelf and get to tell your grandkids a story about how this one time a company that eventually pivoted into an email company tried to build a useless desktop computer.
They had you had an interesting story about them testing out chips, too.
Oh, man, 21, that company. Yeah, like the fact that they cooked their chips because they didn't understand basic encapsulation of at the physics level when it comes to using oil for removal of heat from a mining farm. There's a reason why companies like 3M take, you know, years to test their facilities. Their first major run, I think it was a 28 nanometer, I could be wrong about that. They bought $20 million in chips and just dunked them all in the 3M stuff. And because they didn't dimple the chips, they just cooked all of them simultaneously.
Yeah, you'd think they would test one, you know?
This actually just goes back to exactly what we were talking about. No one does due diligence anymore for anything. It's just scammers, scamming, scammers, scamming, scammers. So
it seems like this is something you're passionate about is scammers.
Very.
Which scams should we start with first?
I don't know. I actually think it's a general problem in the world. No one wants to do any work anymore.
Why is that?
I don't know. Like there's this weird transition that's happened where it's like everyone just wants to fucking Netflix and chill all day or whatever, and no one wants to do any of the work to actually like improve society. I actually think it goes to a broader thing you and I have talked about before.
Yeah.
Which is that humanity is in a race between socialism and capitalism.
Really?
Capitalism is racing towards a post-scarcity environment, and socialism is racing towards everyone's the exact same person, regardless of who you are, where you're from, how much money you have. Both of them are laudable goals to some extent. Some of them are insane, some of them are not. But it's just, I don't know. I don't know what's happened. No one wants to do any damn work.
That's something that we've been talking a lot about. There seems to be like a detachment from reality in every aspect of the world.
Right, I think I just boil it down to just like even when we were talking about scams, whatever. I don't think there's. It's like if you can explain something by human stupidity over malicious intent, you should probably go with human stupidity. So you can generally make sense of most things by just boiling it down to human stupidity.
Hanlon's rule.
Yeah. So in terms of like due diligence KYC stuff, it like they don't do that much work, but there's like this bare minimum threshold that everybody's gotten used to with this paperwork bureaucracy, and it makes sense. Like the bureaucracy, it's like complicated in some ways, but it doesn't go deep enough to actually.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But it's a mess. Like to go through it is a mess, but it's actually not testing for
anything useful.
Yeah.
So I work with some major banks, and they're lamenting, Canadian banks I'll talk about first. So they're lamenting, they have like three challenges. One, the regulators like them to basically fill out all this paperwork about all this thing they're doing. But the paperwork doesn't really do anything. It's just the regulators being able to say, I got this
checklist.
Form. Yeah, checklist. So they're like, all right, well, that doesn't actually do anything from the bank's perspective when it comes to minimizing their actual exposure to risk or their actual exposure to what might be money laundering or might be, you know, nefarious activity either externally or internally to the bank. Second one is this new rule in Canada in 2018 made it so that the banks are responsible for the privacy of the data of their users, and they're not allowed to share user data between themselves or other banks. And then at the same time, the bank has a mandate to know the risk profile of their users. So how can I do that if I can't query information from someone else? I don't understand why this is the case, but regulators are regulators. So I don't know. There's a difference between, like you said, there's a difference between the the threshold that people can say that they've met the law and what's actually useful. And doing the actually useful work is increasingly done by fewer and fewer people.
Yeah, it's like, it's getting to a point where it's so arduous, the sunk cost of complying for a lot of these companies, and it just seems like regulations are never being taken away. They're always being added. Like, are we hitting a head where it's like, all right, we need to fucking rework the way this whole system is from a compliance to
I think
whole...
everybody's been saying it forever.
Right?
But it's like, how is that going to change? Like, we go through periods of deregulation trying to simplify processes, but it's always going to revert back to just complicated paperwork mess. Because it's like how just governance and governments and work, like there's always this knee-jerk reaction to try and solve like small problems and not look at the large scope of things. So it's like, you know, if we didn't have more rigorous, this is kind of what socialism is. It's we'll always revert to socialism because we always want to solve every problem. Like, we always want to put a stop sign or a light at a street where there was a car accident. And so you look at everybody looks very micro to solve problems. And so that then just creates bureaucracy and a bureaucratic mess that just will always happen.
It's always backwards looking. It's never really forward looking.
Yeah. So this is the problem with some of AOC's shit, where she's talking about how now that corporations who are providing leverage, credit, or financing should be responsible for the outcomes of the people that they're providing leverage, credit, or financing to. And then it's like, where does that stop? Does it stop? Does it end up with like the shareholder in the company who provided the leverage to the company that provided the service to the person that fucked up? Is that person culpable? Because if that is finance, as we know, it doesn't work anymore. Because that means I can't lend anyone money without knowing everything they're going to do with the money beforehand. Right. Like, the madness associated with, like, the amount of fucking diligence you'd have to do with that is absurd. You can't know what someone's going to do in the future.
People eat it up. Well, love it. It gets back to what you said earlier. It's a race against capitalism and socialism. What's winning, in your opinion? Right?
Capitalism.
Yeah?
Well, yeah, because profit is king, dude. Like, cash flow is king, and socialists don't make any money. So it's just like, so that ultimately is one of the reasons why they fail. It's why New York is pissed about the loss of the Amazon process. Like, six out of 10 people or 7 out of 10 people is like, what the fuck? Like, yes, New York has broader infrastructure problems that need to be challenged. You don't solve those challenges by driving away tax dollars.
They were getting a $9 billion tax break, though, dude. Or $3 billion. What was
it? That money doesn't exist. Like, it didn't exist. You have to earn money in order to give a tax break in the first place. It's absurd.
AOC is the biggest blessing that I've seen the last couple of years, where it's finally divided, like, liberals in terms of what they actually are. I mean, there's been such a unified liberal mindset of how things should be. This is the first time I've ever seen there actually be, like, large debates internally on the left.
And it's... You know what a debate I would love to see is, I've said this on this podcast before, is AOC versus Thomas Sowell. Two people from two neighborhoods that are very close together with very divergent views on how the economy should work. And that's a lot of, like, AOC's platform. There's a lot of virtue signaling for people in certain neighborhoods and certain conditions.
Yeah, and look, I understand. The world sucks for a lot of people. And it sucks in a lot of cases. And it does. Yeah. Like, the world is not a fair place.
Yes.
But, and that's the difference. Like, I this is why I don't think it's worthwhile to be an activist, because the way you change the world is the use of a substantial amount of money, not by clamoring to take from other people to try and solve what you want to solve, because I think that's theft, so.
No, and I would agree. But it's crazy how many people are buying into it these days, after the long history of socialism's failures.
It's a very sexy idea. Like, yeah. It's very appealing. If you have nothing, it's super appealing to suddenly be given something.
What about Yang Gang and the Freedom Dividend?
That's a whole.
Let's secure the bag. Are we securing the bag this election season?
I just think it's. I think it's natural. It's natural. There's an natural inclination to socialism always. I think. We were talking about this yesterday, Marty. That I think in, like, I was like 14, 15, I was a hardcore socialist. And like, when you start getting interested in politics, you want to enact change, and like, you feel powerful about it. There's something very seductive about that. And it takes a little bit of wisdom and life experience to understand how bad that could actually get. Like, it takes wisdom to understand that your thoughts of utopia are, like, you can't fix nuanced problems.
Exactly. Now, I would love that you said that life isn't fair. That's, like, one thing that my mom mentally beat into us. She's like, life's not fair. Get used to it.
It's literally drives the... It's one of the fundamental conditions that you have to understand is that you have to try.
You have to compete.
You have to do something to be useful. Like... And if you're okay, and this is one of the reasons why I'm so alarmed by the Green New Deal shit too. I mean, yeah, it'd be great if we had $1 trillion in renewable energy built out across the United States. That would be fantastic. I'm all about it. But if you try and couple that with social activist change, like the original language was, she wanted to provide a universal basic income for those unwilling to work.
Unwilling.
Dude, what the fuck?
Like, it was a typo. It was a typo there. Don't worry.
The whole sentence. Do you have any idea what happens to society if you allow people to just sit on their ass? More people are like, oh, I'm going to sit on my ass too. Why would I bother working for marginally more if I can sit on my ass and have enough? Now, if we're in a post-scarcity world where gold is a penny, platinum is a penny, palladium is a penny an ounce, because we pulled some asteroid shit out of the sky and we... quintuple trillion the total supply of those rare resources and everything's cheap as a result, fine. If the production of shit costs nothing, then it doesn't matter if we give shit away. Okay,
we're not quite there yet.
We're a ways from that. I actually buy into Bezos's idea is that we should the race is towards post scarcity as fast as possible. It's different from Musk's. Musk's approach is like build a secondary lifeboat for humanity. Bezos is like, fuck that. Let's fucking...
asteroid mine.
Yeah, let's asteroid mine as soon as possible.
Yeah. And so let's tie it into Bitcoin on this podcast. Yeah. Like, how does Bitcoin sort of change?
Well, humanity needs a sound money unit.
Okay, why do you believe this?
A lot of the problems that occur in intermittent and ongoing economic arrangements have to do with the fact that you have counterparty risk associated with the use of a fiat vehicle. And that has to do with the fact that when you have government, when government is responsible for both the monetary and fiscal policy, so when a government is responsible for the maintenance of the unit of account and at the same time is responsible for collecting dollars in that unit of account, so collecting and spending dollars in the unit of account, you eventually get to a point where the government runs out of money. Because governments do that, they spend what they have, and then they go, oh, wait a second, I can just print money, and now I can do more things. So you have like this kind of perverse feedback loop that ultimately ends up with the government debasing the population's mechanics for the use of just the tools of commerce, and you get situations like Venezuela, you get situations like Hungary, you get situations like Germany, you get situations like Argentina, you get situations like Zimbabwe, where... The government's just like, well, we just print another $500 billion. Who cares? Because they don't. They're in a position of power that empowers them to do that, and that feedback that feeds back into the economy at a rate that's dependent on the information asymmetry available to people who understand the dynamics of money as it pertains to the system, and that causes problems.
Yeah, that's actually prescient topic, because Matt and I went to Baruch College this morning. We spoke in front of a class of young youths interested in Bitcoin and blockchain.
Always be shilling.
Oh, jeez.
And we popped up the St. Louis Fred chart, and I think it was like the first time any of these kids have seen
that one.
Like,
got them. That right? was immediately what this, got them.
The Fed monetary base chart.
What was their background to crypto before this?
They're in a class at Baruch pertains to quote unquote blockchain.
Okay,
so the blockchain undergrad class.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
But yeah, it opened up a lot of minds, and it goes back to the fact that people don't know what money is, number one. And then number two, when they do figure it out, they're like, holy shit, what are we doing? But a good question one of the students asks is, if Bitcoin does become successful, will it slow down the economy? And we had a very good conversation about that. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts.
So I'm not like super hardcore where I think Bitcoin removes fiat dollars. Mm-hmm. It just puts a cap on government's abilities to move against their population's best interests. But it's not like we don't already have sound asset groups, which have performed exceptionally well over the last 30 years, 50 years, 100 years of debasement of the dollar. Art, property, land, political contributions, to the extent that you think you can purchase people or their output. Those are all things that have rapidly appreciated in price relative to the dollar base, because they are things that are worth something. A Picasso, there is only one of them of that specific type. So long as there is a fiction around the story about its value, people buy into that fiction, similar to how you buy into the fiction of the money. And as a result, it's worth something. And because it has scarcity, it's worth more over time, because that group of people want the thing. They don't, insofar as it's a liquid market, quote unquote, they have the ability to rapidly enter and exit from those more solid asset bases. So it's not like sound money units don't already exist. They're just not as flexible or not as...
liquid, right? Bitcoin's way more liquid,
yeah.
though.
Yeah,
that's the difference.
As a result of its... As a result of the properties of public key cryptography, yes, it gains a bunch of benefits associated with ease of transfer between people. So that is one of the things that... And as a result of the same public key cryptography mechanics, the ease of catching whether or not something is a counterfeit is categorically easier in Bitcoin. If you have 102 blocks on a Bitcoin transaction, you're pretty much guaranteed that it's not a counterfeit. So,
yeah, no, it's a fascinating topic, and then we got into like the KPIs of the economy right now. Like, are we like for what we're performance tuning for in today's economy? Like, is that the right thing to tune performance towards going forward? Like, should we rethink like our KPIs of the economy? Like, obviously, we want GDP growth and stuff like that, but obviously that's leading us to precarious situations, I would argue. So interested to hear anybody's thoughts on that.
So I'd say, and I talked about this in Pierre's podcast a little bit too, due to the dynamic of the majority of people literally can't save. They're not in a position to save money. Bitcoin as a monetary unit right now is a much better savings vehicle than it is a spending vehicle. So for people who are not in a capacity to save, their cash flow is essentially equivalent to their cash out. Bitcoin really right now isn't for them. They are not in a position to save in any form, let alone whether or not Bitcoin is the form of savings. Yeah. And that gets to kind of a psychological and I guess it's a function of the economy. I guess you could use it as a KPI, which is what percentage of people are actively saving money. Like actively saving value in any mm-hmm. form or fashion. It was like there was a really interesting study that showed like something like 65% of Americans can't take a $3,000 hit without
40% can't take a $400 hit.
Yeah, yeah. What the fuck, man. It's crazy. It's
$400. Like, if you fucking had an $400 emergency expense, I think it is 60%. 60% of Americans cannot cover that.
Yeah,
that's outrageous.
It's just, like I mean, in terms of KPIs, it's like the government. It broadly speaking is just trying to jerry-rig every like the economy, and like I think we'll look back at this time period decades from now and be like that's such a weird thing to
like do. The CPI. Like, why are we fine-tuning for the CPI?
Like, Social Security.
Small, a small group of people trying to understand a very nuanced system. It's like this is why capitalism works, because nobody's trying to figure it out. Like we let it naturally. Flow, right? So it's like there's unintended consequences of every action on a system, and I don't think we fully understand all of the actions that we've been making on the system. Where it's starting, there was pretty consensus view on Wall Street, broadly in the markets, that we're in for some tough times over the next 5 to 10 years. Very consensus view. People are thinking more year, 2 years time frame that the party's still happening, and like we have this Fed put, and that's going to keep things rolling. It's so everybody's thinking very near term, but I think it's becoming a consensus view longer term that something's really off about this, and that we've put ourselves in a position that we pretty much can't get out of at this point.
Gotta be some pain.
Yeah. So
much pain are we talking?
It's pretty bad. Pretty bad, dude. If 60% of Americans can't afford a $400 fucking emergency expense, imagine if there's like a 20% contraction in the economy.
We're talking about like the fabric of society. Like, how fickle is it right now?
Well, I mean, this is one of the reasons why you should have bullets, butter, and water in your home at all times. So, in the event this shit goes tits up, you have
need butter.
Yeah, yeah.
You need butter is the important one.
Yeah, so it's extremely high caloric value. Like, well, I mean, we see it when you have short term disruptions in normal economic functions. Within 72 hours, people are looting.
Right.
So, and that's alarming. For a whole bunch of reasons. Meanwhile, you have people like the stablecoin guys, and I'm going to say stablecoin in this case is separate from the custody money. Custody money is can be useful, like the like tethered dollars, all that kind of shit. That can be useful.
Like the fiat backed,
fiat or asset backed,
right?
But the ones who are trying to reinvent the like the algorithmatized stable value ones, those guys are fucking ridiculous.
Banker, is that like it's banker? Basis? It was Basis and Maker, right?
Banker.
Yeah, yeah.
No,
oh, Bancor. Yeah.
B-A-N-C-O.
It's a little bit different. We were talking about this yesterday of how a lot of crypto is just a derivative off of... I think I said this on the last podcast as well. Is derivative off of Bitcoin, trying to solve the problems of Bitcoin and not understanding the whole picture, and therefore becoming like this morphed weird child that doesn't make any sense. So it like that's most of crypto. It's like it's a derivative off of this main problem at its core that was like... It's grassroots and it's not going away, and like it's evolved in a very, very weird way, thinking very micro, and will obviously end terribly at some point in the near future.
Yeah.
But they think about like marketing to VCs, basically.
Yes.
Right? That's what they're doing.
It's like, I think people believe like their own this illusion or delusion. It's it's like very reflexive, so I'm like very hesitant to call anything a scam, because I think people can do very, very dumb things for a prolonged period of time
because of their own belief system.
So this is a perfectly natural transition to Ethereum. What do we think about Ethereum 2.0?
Oh my god. I mean, I talked about that at Tone's confiscatable thing. One, it's super alarming that it appears about 6 people are making decisions for the network.
It's decentralized, dude. That's not 6 people. Are you kidding me?
World computer,
world operating system. Yeah.
So let's talk about how much this idea of Ethereum has changed over the last 5 years.
So
this is gonna be a long conversation.
Yeah. So someone's gonna miss their flight. Yeah, I understand the interest of what's behind it, and that is it would be nice if in a key management schema, I as a person can enter into arbitrary contracting relationships with you. Such that we can have guarantees around the outcomes of the contract or outcomes of the position that we take between us in such a way that the arbitration costs of the contract going awry or going correct are near zero. The problem is that we don't live in the hypothesized 2077 world where everything is hooked up to everything and everything communicates to everything and everything is trustless and everything is strongly authenticated. We live in a world where people barely do due diligence. Okay, so the problem with that outcome is that the entire system doesn't exist in this kind of parallel world. It exists in the current world where single people or single institutions or single organizations are who decide what the outcomes and the outputs are based on the actual real world undergoing things. So you have a system that speaks to a future where people can do these distributed actions amongst each other and don't have to trust one another because of the underlying system. But due to the dynamics of the actual mechanics of the world, it's useless. It doesn't do anything. The most used platform on it is a loan platform to loan people money.
The most used thing is Maker being used to lever up ETH, pretty much.
Guys, DeFi, it's taking over the world.
But may sound slightly disingenuous because we're ETH short thesis, but broadly speaking, I'm a fan of the idea of what Ethereum is and potentially proof of stake. Like we were talking about this yesterday, I mean, we had a lot of these long conversations yesterday. I think my view of what like crypto is, though, like Taleb said this, or he was quoting somebody, is that like on the federal level you want to be libertarian, on the state level Republican, on the county level Democratic, and family level socialist. So governance really depends on the level of what you're talking about, and I can agree with you there. Bitcoin is libertarian, and because we're agreeing on the smallest amount of things that for the system to work off of, it can become a global money, and that's what like global money should be. Now, for like a smaller system, potentially something like a proof of stake can work, where if you know the intentions of all of the other people in the system, you can agree on more things.
Like local validators that you can go knock on their doors.
Or like 10 banks agreeing with each other.
Yeah, so there's some things that Proof of Stake and Johnny's worked on federated sidechains and whatnot.
For a while.
But Proof of Authority works pretty well in that situation too, right?
Well, yeah, so ultimately...
Just like validators that are approved.
Yeah. So the ultimate version of that is going to be deterministic hardware that has like a hardware security module. So that ultimately is going to be the long range. Sorry, guys.
No, but sticking on Ethereum, like, this is one thing that perplexes me, especially their announcement to move to 2.0. It's like, what does this say? Like, has Ethereum failed? Have they admitted failure?
I don't think Ethereum's ever known what it is or what it's supposed to be. It's always, like, it's a derivative of Bitcoin, and it's always compared itself to Bitcoin. And so it's got caught up in this, like, what are we? Like, how do we differentiate ourselves from Bitcoin? So because of that, there's not a very clear identity. Like, the identity of Ethereum versus Bitcoin when it got started, and even today, is that, like, we're very pro-innovation, we're very, like, progressive, right? There's an issue with that because, like, you never settle on any identity. There's never a threshold for, like, what we are.
And there's always something better.
Exactly. So, like, this is why you see everybody who... This is this large debate that's going on in the Ethereum community right now about Ethereum maximalism. Ethereum maximalism is becoming a thing. And it's like they're all realizing...
It's beautiful irony.
They're realizing
it's fucking awesome is what it is.
They're realizing all of the trials and tribulations of what Bitcoiners have been going through, that there is a problem with only being progressive. This ties into general politics as well. Like, you need a balance between innovation and conservatism. Like, you need... Like, there needs to be a cultural... Since these are all... Like, all these systems... There's tech, and the protocols are rigorous, but what underlies the rigor of the tech protocol is still social. The social layer is in every governance system. The social layer, the participants of the system, ultimately decide what the system rules are. Bitcoin has decided that we're going to make, like, we know what our social rules are, and we're going to stand by them, and we're going to make the threshold for changing very, very high. So we have a lot of stickiness to it. And in many ways, Bitcoin is extremely progressive, but compared to the rest of the crypto systems, it looks extremely conservative.
Your average person is super progressive. Right? Would you say
the average person,
like that
no coiner
that knows like normal economic theory, that's like,
are you talking about like generally or in crypto?
No. Just the average person that's not even exposed to cryptocurrency at all.
Most people don't know what they are. Most people spend no time thinking about anything, and they're just parroting what they hear.
Right.
So I very few people actually spend a fair amount of time in thinking about what they want their system to be. It is, as we were talking about before, I genuinely think that there's a natural gravity to socialism because there's always going to be more activist energy there, and the people who are easily, like most people, like 99% of people are easily swayed, and so they're easily swayed by emotional arguments, they're just going to follow that. But overwhelmingly, generally, people don't care about most things. Like,
it's like Ethereum. Like, it's really nice in theory.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, socialism has like got great marketing lines. Great things that if everything worked perfectly, it might be awesome.
If like, I guess this is a good way of putting it. Like, most people spend all of their time not caring about most things, and then when it's time to vote, they're presented with an emotional appeal. They're going to be swayed by the emotional appeal. So
I mean, this week is a perfect highlight of that with the Mueller report and everything that went on with that for the last 2 years.
But people have been hearing on the news about a side of the argument that was shown, like, concretely, this is definitely what's happening, so nobody was really questioning it. That's been the comment that I've stayed away from talking about politics for several years now. You're gonna make me pull up onto this. But it honestly is the best example of that. If you were gonna even say, like, I don't believe that there was Russian tempering in the elections, people would laugh at you.
but the last couple of years. We don't even have to get like specific with the Mueller.
Most people still don't even believe it because it's just so now ingrained for the last couple of years. Like, this definitely happened.
I mean, it's coming out that there were some untruths in the reporting that's been going on. That's like, 99% of people are going to these news sources and taking what they say and taking it at face value and turning around. And,
but at the same time, so those happen, like those would be dinner conversations and people. But I believe most people outside of those conversations really don't spend that much energy thinking about things. But that's kind of the problem, is because once they are, and once there's elections, and once there is times to like vote on policy, people could be very easily swayed.
Yeah. No, it's how do we get people to start thinking about this or caring about it? Can we? Or is it
too large of a problem? Yeah. When you're trying to I think the best you can do is tell the truth, and you have to be optimistic. That like in the long term, the truth always wins, right? And so people can be swayed emotionally for a period of time, but eventually they'll come back.
Yeah, no, the truth does prevail.
I mean, what happens if it's just everything's just broken?
There's a chance that it happens, but I think you have to be optimistic. I mean,
Bitcoin gives me peace of mind, right? It's like you have a completely separate protocol, separate network that's just. Has no idea what's going on in the outside world, just doesn't care, just does its own thing,
yeah,
according to the specifications.
Yeah. Well, the sound money thing is something that we've really never had before, and how that could change things is we really don't know. And then that's why I got into all this, is that I was socialist in high school, I turned libertarian post high school, then I stopped caring about politics. It's something that gives people back like an individualism, and that how that can change things. I only see that as being like a very net positive.
Yeah, personal sovereignty, taking control back into your own hands.
It's not even personal sovereignty; it's personal responsibility, because it forces you to exude extreme ownership over yourself and the custody of your wealth to some extent.
Yeah, there's very few things in society nowadays where if you fuck it up, someone can just unequivocally turn to you and be like, that was your fuck up. And in Bitcoin, I feel like that's all that happens. Like every single time someone loses money, you're like, that was you, bro.
What individualism encourages is people like seeking their own truths. So it makes it less likely that groups of people fall into this collective delusion. So, and this is why capitalism long-term works much more better than communism and socialism. Because in communism and socialism, you're essentially tying the whole system together. So once there starts fracturing in some ways, it's going to have a catastrophic collapse. With capitalism, the system is much more individualistic, and it allows for the individuals to fail by themselves. And so the whole system can never be compromised. Like the what's weak always burns off, and what prevails is long term better. And so I think like if you're a capitalist, you have to have a optimistic. I think this is what the temperament of a socialist and a capitalist is. Capitalist long term believes that people can like the truth prevails. Like people, the individual, like,
and then the incentives prevail. The money prevails. Yeah.
I think socialists are approaching the world where human beings are corrupt. We need to fix them, and we need to fix them in like a very dramatic way.
You change chemistry. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is why like I'm getting very like hesitant and scary when people are trying to think about influencing a whole system. But like, how do we change this? Like we're talking about activism. I think like I'm hesitant of it's just present the truths and they propagate by themselves. Like you don't need to like hold somebody down and like yell at their face and be like, this is how it needs to be. So like it's extremely what's the word I'm looking for? I'm pretentious. It's extremely grandizing to think that like what I think is right, and so you should all believe what I'm thinking. I think it's a little more humble to say, like, my views may not be correct. Let's let this play out. Like the winner wins, and that's probably better for everybody.
Right, and I think if we're talking about externalities within Bitcoin, this is the article that was dropped in the Wall Street Journal today about Steve Barber and Upstream Data and what they're doing in Alberta by capping the natural gas. Like this is an overt solution to a big problem that the world is talking about right now, which is global warming and energy efficiency. And it's not governments throwing a bunch of money and making it more efficient. It's the free market basically finding a way to make it more efficient.
Yeah, there's two ways to look at global. I don't think it's everybody agrees that there's potentially a very large problem with global warming, CO2 emission, and all that. I think the debate that can't happen, that nobody wants to have the productive conversation about, is what's the best way of going about it. And the very emotional side of it is we need like massive action by governments that will like force all these
mass regulation.
Yeah. Which I don't know, I think this is a complicated issue. I don't pretend to think that I have the answers to it at all. I think the opposite.
No, but I think
yeah,
historically, governments throwing money at problems is not really solving.
Yeah, that's my major
way.
Hesitation with it.
You need cooperation. Yeah. You need global cooperation. That's never going to fucking happen. We've never had global cooperation.
This is a weird example of just cooperation to enact change, but like militias or whatever, like a grassroots movements that people have banded together to solve where there wasn't any enforcement, and those have forced major changes in various parts of history.
Militias to save global warming.
I'm saying like just grassroots movements do happen, right? And Bitcoin is. Bitcoin is an example of some people weren't forced to do anything. Everybody's kind of risen up individually and they've bought into this idea themselves that we all agree on too. Is like, I think that's I have an optimistic view of humanity and human beings that Bitcoin's a good thing and that's happened for a reason. I think in my hopeful view that should happen with global warming as well. Like everybody should genuinely see a problem and the grassroots movement should force things so people can stop using products from companies that are causing major problems, and that could be the best way of solving it. Is that there's gonna be a lot of unintended consequences of like global governments all banding together to make hard rules on something. But I don't know. I may be too optimistic about human beings, so I don't know. We'll see.
I'm optimistic, too. And hey, you freaks out there, if you go to the bodega, don't get a bag. Just carry out your stuff. You're never going to need a bag for
bring
the
bring your
bag.
Own bag.
Or bring your own bag.
Yeah, BYOB.
BYOB.
It's kind of weird where like governments aren't letting people do good themselves, right? It's like, is it a good... this is my view of charity as well. It's like in taxes, right? Is forcing people to pay for something, like we want to like sit back and look like that's a net good thing, but was there any actual genuine good act in it? Like a genuine good act is doing something when you weren't required to do it and really not talking about it at all. Like there was other no net benefit for your image or anything else, that it was actually a genuinely good act.
Yeah, like helping the neighbor bring in the groceries, you don't tell people when you go inside.
Holding the door. Big one.
It's another one, too.
Especially in New York.
No one
holds the door.
I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this. What if the government were to enact a regulation for these fracking and drilling sites that said if you have so much flare, you need to cap that and mine Bitcoin with it?
But they're kind of doing that.
I don't believe in regulation at all. I think, things should be nuanced, right? Like, I'm not a libertarian where no regulation, all regulation is bad. I think this is what kind of changed my view getting deeper into economics in college. Was like there could be, there's points of a system where the system resonates out of control. And so like you need to find the areas of where a system can resonate and kind of cap those, but be very, very careful of not going farther than you have to. So like regulating oil and gas in certain ways, I think, is definitely required.
Yeah. That's one regulation I've thought of. Like, if you want to help global warming and you want to regulate in a way, don't take money from people. Be like, hey, if we have a means to use this energy, you should use it. And if you're not being efficient with it, you're getting fined.
But Bitcoin does that, right?
I'd love for Bitcoin to be involved in regulation as well. Yeah.
Bitcoin does that naturally through its incentives, right? Because we already have the regulation that says you can't flare a certain amount, mm-hmm. right? So now they have to cap their production because they can't flare a certain amount. So Steve Barber comes in with upstream data and he goes, you guys don't have to stop production. Not only that, you can even reclaim some money from your flaring at the same exact time. And they don't have to actually put in the regulation anywhere that you have to do Bitcoin mining, right? That's just the natural end result because we have good incentives set up where there's a financial incentive to fucking do it, right? Like, if you have a financial incentive to do something, it's way more likely that people will do it than just if you tell them, you know, they have to play ball or else.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to become some statist. I was just throwing that idea.
You sound very statist.
I know. It did sound statist. I'm sorry.
You damn statist.
We were just talking about...
Johnny Dilly's back.
Johnny's back.
Johnny just had a call. We were talking about...
He's wearing a Greg Maxwell shirt as well.
It always stares at you.
Greg's staring at me and Matt at the same time.
Well,
that's weird.
I wore a Jihan Wu shirt at Unconfiscatable. You gotta rep the brand. Yeah, you gotta rep the
Jihan.
Brand.
Sorry, Jihan.
R.I.P.
Bad news week for Jihan. Where did they fuck up, in your opinion?
trusting Craig Wright in any way, shape, or form?
I don't think that was the beginning of the problems.
Fine. So I would say that is one example of them making an error. The biggest error they made is thinking that they can drive consensus in Bitcoin.
Right.
No, part of the entire point is, and this should be a humbling fact, and it also should be an empowering fact, Bitcoin doesn't give a fuck about you.
She's a cruel, unforgiving bitch.
But she also loves you.
Right.
Okay? Like, she cares about you. She cares about humanity.
Tough love.
Yeah, it's really tough love. And that's one of the reasons why I think we're going to have some longer-term socialist action against Bitcoin is because, you know, they're going to try and take your keys.
Which the weirdest thing to me is there are a fair amount of...
How are they going to try and take your keys?
They're going to make you disclose addresses, first of all. Yeah, right? Disclose addresses and balances.
And then it's like, oh, you know, every time you send a transaction, you got to make sure you pay Uncle Sam.
The weirdest phenomenon to me at all is that there is a fair amount of socialists in crypto. I mean, right? They definitely don't fall to the Bitcoin side, but like
the unicorn crowd, like the
unicorn punk.
It's something that it like fundamentally doesn't really make that much sense,
right?
I don't know, but right. Yeah.
No. It's all young people who want change, who see a bad world,
right?
And want change, and they have different.
I guess you could explain it. maybe oversimplifying the socialist mindset, but it's a very fragmented view of how reality worked, and it's just very wrong. So it makes sense that things don't make sense in their view.
It's not that surprising.
Yeah.
So I mean, if you think about it, like, the world has always been capitalistic. Everything, nature is capitalistic.
Yeah.
The consumption and ownership of resources is basically like is what makes you more dominant or less dominant than someone else. Now, does that mean the biggest cougar doesn't sometimes get killed by, like, a spontaneous avalanche? No. Like, that happens. It happens all the time. But at the end of the day, nature is literally about marshalling resources for your own selfish best interests.
Right. Selfish gene. It's gonna persist throughout time.
I actually never read that.
That was a great metaphor. Large cougar getting the avalanche.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Sometimes it happens.
Let's have a short dinosaur tangent. Can you explain the spine dinosaur that you were?
Oh, Spinosaurus. Yeah. Well, first off, they found a ten.
I missed this.
They found a 10-ton Tyrannosaurus Rex in Canada like 2 weeks ago, named Scotty. So that was 2 tons larger than any Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Where did you read about this?
It's somewhere on the internet, National Geographic or something. All right. So yes, I guess I could have been like super black pilled and it's just all fake. But you know. Information is information, okay? So everyone can do your own due diligence, okay?
Do your own dinosaur research,
yeah,
people.
Yeah.
Do your own dinosaur
research. So T-Rex had actually been relegated into, like, the smaller, large apex predators.
It was a beta apex?
Yeah, because, like, there were Carnotaurus, Gigantosaurus, and all these other larger creatures, like Megaraptor, were just proving to be more vicious, higher-order predators because of their size. Now we know that an adult T-Rex can be as large as 10 or 12 tons. It's competing again. But nothing competes against Spinosaurus. Spinosaurus is a fucking monster.
Spinosaurus is a boss.
Dude, the spine on Spinosaurus alone is larger than most apex predators. Like, his spine, just the bone structure that he used for heating and cooling and hunting. And just the bone spine.
And that was our dinosaur tangent of the day.
Yeah.
We had a 15-minute conversation on dinosaurs before you got here, Tom.
I'm really sorry I missed it.
Dude, it's
fascinating.
I have to get back to it.
How did that even come up?
Because my boy. Because he's into it. So then if he's going to be into it, like, I'm reading the books to him. So okay, like, and I'm like, what? This is so awesome.
That makes a whole lot more sense.
Because think about it. In the 20 or 25 years since you were last, like, super into dinosaurs, because most human males are into dinosaurs when they're young. It's just, like, it's a thing because they're cool.
My nephew's into it right now.
So 25 years have passed, and the paleo, whatever they're called, the paleontologists, have, like, discovered all this new stuff, and it's kind of ridiculous. Like, I was telling them about, and we'll end this after this. Sorry, it's just so cool. there's this new breed of raptor called the Utah raptor they've been doing research on. Turns out, Utah raptor, this thing would have been terrifying in the modern era. Covered in photochromatic feathers, so it was semi-active camo when it's standing still, okay?
Yeah.
Like chameleon status, all right? It was like 32 feet long, okay? Weighed like 6 tons, can move like 35 miles an hour, okay? Has echolocation and strong communication between hunting packs.
This sounds like those bird creatures in Avatar.
A little bit, yes. But like bigger and just hyper aggressive, because hyper aggression is what basically ruled. Like saw something and you just try and kill it because it's meat. So it's like, I want meat. Like the brain process is like, meat, feed me, get. Like 35 miles an hour, terrifying creature chasing after you. And then the ankylosauruses, I was telling you guys about that too. Does your
son know all these stats?
He knows more dinosaur names than I do.
Really?
It's kind of hilarious. He has favorites, and he can list like his 15 favorite dinosaurs.
How old is he now?
3.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
He can say Suchomimus.
Suchomimus?
Yeah.
I can't speak too well, so your son may be able to speak better than
you
me.
You just said it. That was pretty good.
Yeah, it's not
it?
Bad. All right. Now try Baryonyx.
Baryonyx?
Yeah, there we go.
There we go.
All right. Yeah.
Welcome to your local dinosaur pod.
Yeah, come for the Bitcoin, stay for the dinosaur pod.
Well, because the thing about it, it actually kind of applies, because you're talking about how
natural selection.
Yeah, we're talking about selection criteria and the success conditions for capitalism. And if you think about it, the same thing happened to the dinosaurs over hundreds of millions or tens of millions of years. And like I was about to say, the ankylosauruses, with the best example of that being Gastonia, it was covered in a 6-inch bone plate. Its entire upper body.
Insanity.
6-inch bone plate. Like, think about the millions of years of iterative improvements required from like the apex males and the apex females of that species to end up with where you are literally a walking tank.
What were they going through that like forced them to evolve that way? Like, who was like hitting them on the back and some shit?
Well, that's how all of the major predators attacked in 3 ways. T-Rex would do crushing bites. Dinosaurs like Allosaurus, Carnotaurus, Baryonyx, Suchomimus would attack with like this slashing function where they kind of disjoint their jaw and they come in like an axe, and then they hit you, and if they hit you, you bleed out. Because it's a fucking Allosaurus. It's like a 6-ton creature. If its jaw is an axe and it hits you with the full force of itself, you're going to bleed out. And then the third is like the raptors, who use like, they use their leg, the leg claws.
Talon.
Yeah, they use talons to basically inflict the same kind of damage that occurs from the axe creatures.
This is fascinating.
I know, right? So if you think about it, that is literally capitalism.
Right.
Like the evolution of those skills. Like, for example, the reason why the raptors have that the claw that's like arced up, it literally evolved over time so that the claw didn't drag on the ground so it didn't get dull.
Whoa.
That is literally a hundred, if not tens of millions, if not 100 million year innovation to make it so that your claw that you use to kill shit doesn't get dull. And it's just something simple as, like, it's not touching the ground. It's arced up. Which, if you think about it from, like, an evolutionary biology perspective, was, like, there was a chicken at one point, and then the chicken had a slightly sharper claw than everyone else, and then it won as a result of having that. And then one or two apex males had, like, a slight modification where the nail is, like, a little bit off the ground, and as a result, they're more successful predators over time. Yeah. And as a result, they have a larger harem. Like, it's literally capitalism.
Right.
Just...
played out in nature.
Yes, played out in nature with far more vicious outcomes.
I mean, just systems in like the current state of things are always just so much more complicated than we understand. And it's like, to reject how things are, like there's obviously you want a part of that to progress, but to reject things as they are, you don't know why those things are there to begin with, right?
Exactly. And to try to to fix millions of years of evolution one generation.
You're not smarter than evolution. Sorry.
Right? Yeah. Well, let's get back to this concept of us not realizing we're in nature. Or not, I would argue we do, but like a lot of people seem to like abstract humanity from nature.
It's like a hypothecation of our position as just normal creatures that just happen to have some self-reflection capacity.
Right.
We're really not that special.
Right?
Yeah. That's it. Like, that's our innovation. We're actually kind of average, except for that.
What do you mean by that?
Like, think about like a dolphin.
I think you're underplaying
the yes.
We got a human maximalist over here.
Yeah.
It's fine. If you think about, for example, how we would compete in the natural arena of a dolphin, we would lose catastrophically. We are reasonably frail things.
I think I could take a dolphin.
Have you ever jumped in the ocean and like tried to swim? It's fucking terrible.
It's quite hard. We flail. We surf.
I've been surfing my whole life. It's still fucking hard.
Yeah. So no, it's not. Yes, that capacity is a wonderful thing. But I think if we left the chimpanzees and the apes alone for tens of millions of years as well, they will eventually evolve into that capacity as well. We have chimpanzees and apes that can do fairly complicated things. Yeah. Some of them are smarter than the average sixth grader.
We have crows using vending machines.
In different ways,
I was watching something the other day about chimps, how they can they can see a flash of a pattern of numbers. Like up to like, I don't know, like 20 or something, flash of it, and then track those numbers where they were.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So they have different working numbers.
The consciousness thing, I think, is a different
concept. And then they get the concept of fairness, too. Did you see that study where the one monkey was getting grapes and the other was getting cucumbers? Or they were both getting grapes at one point, and then at some point the researcher switched from giving one a grape and the other a cucumber, and the one that got the cucumber was so pissed off because the other one was getting a grape and he was getting a cucumber. And he just like, got that inherent unfairness of the situation.
I would prefer eating the cucumber personally.
Yeah, that's interesting. That was an interesting preference by the chimp.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe they...
Well, grapes are higher in sugar, so that's true. There's probably some mechanical, chemical thing going on.
No, sorry, we are animals. People forget that. Be aware, freaks, you're animals.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't reject, don't try to be better than that.
But do as well.
But do as well.
Yoda. Well, this is where I think, if we can get to post-scarcity... Everything's gonna be fine. Everything's gonna be fine. All right. It's like that's.
The I point. Like that line. Let's, everything's let's gonna jump be into fine.
Post-scarcity. Yeah. How do we get there? So, what does it look like?
So think about a lot of the resources that are used in the higher order, mechanically sophisticated machines we use today: TV, recorder, laptop, computer,
21 computer,
21 computer,
Macallan,
a car, a fabricator for chips themselves. A mining company, a boring company, all these things require expensive metals, catalysts like platinum, palladium, iridium, fuel sources and energy sources to run. If I can pull an asteroid out of the sky that has 100 million times more current supply of the total stock of gold, palladium and platinum on the Earth, the prices of those goods drop to nothing, and the cost of building machines that currently are limited in builds or infrastructure that's costly to build because of the power constraints or the power costs of building them or the machining costs for building the machines or the machines themselves, if we remove the major cost bases from those, building more infrastructure gets radically cheaper, and suddenly we don't have all these fucking hard conversations about making resource delineation choices because we have so many fucking resources. It's a fucking no-brainer.
How far away from mining asteroids are we?
Oh, that's a great question.
Do we know how many asteroids are passing us?
I got pitched on a really interesting, and by really interesting, I mean a total scam. a blockchain where they were going to sell you percentages of asteroids that had rare earth metals in them.
Yeah, that sounds super legit.
And then when it's worth enough money, go get them and bring them back. So you're the owner for now.
You have a put option.
This fucking asteroid. Good luck getting at it, but don't worry, you own it. It's yours. It's your asset.
How can they tell what materials are on the asteroid before they decide to mine it?
There's some methods. Yeah. That, like there's like resin.
It has to be on the blockchain as well.
Oh yeah, 100%.
With 100%. AI and machine learning.
Yeah. Too. Because think about what that would do to world markets. If you went and you pulled one of those asteroids, you came back with it, and let's say you you don't drop it like a fucking meteor on Earth, but you just like you keep idiot. It there. Yeah, yeah. But you keep it there. If whoever owns that asteroid owns massive percentages more of the total supply of all the rare earth metals on Earth.
It'd be great for Bitcoin.
Everyone who is holding those metals is worth nothing now. Right. Worth nothing. The resources that they were hoarding or using or kept in the ground or were holding in banks, nothing, instantaneously. It's one of the reasons why I'm short gold in the long run.
Short gold, long Bitcoin.
Yeah, in the long run. I right now, gold's not a terrible hedge.
So. Like, how far away from a type 1 civilization are we?
What does that mean?
Like, harnessing all the energy on the Earth and in our star. I feel
like, oh, you mean like a Dyson sphere?
Yeah.
That kind of shit? We're a ways from that. we're having trouble getting people to agree to build nuclear power plants, okay? Like, yeah. Let alone fucking the infrastructure requirements around building a Dyson sphere. Oh, speaking of, Brian Bishop had a really interesting way to solve global warming. You send a satellite up with a thin plastic film, and then you just put the plastic film in front of the fucking sun, and it just drops the solar radiation by like 1%. Solves all of our problems.
It's better. It seems better than chemtrailing ourselves with the particles that people want to do to solve it. Have you heard that?
No.
What's that? People want to drop like a certain chemical. Like in the atmosphere.
I heard that. Yeah, we're just building up clouds or whatever.
It's like cloud seeding and shit like that, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Isn't that what they did in the Matrix?
It's like terraforming.
They ended up killing everyone.
They like bombed the sky to blot out the sun because the machines were solar. Using solar, yeah, and solar, they just used human blood as their energy source after that.
I can see that as the end result. You know, us fucking with trying to chemically change the environment and fucking with it too much.
Yeah, I'd rather not. I'd rather try to not.
Well, that's what Bezos wants, to turn the Earth into just light industry and residency. I mean, heavy industry in space.
Why wouldn't we live in space?
Why would we
live in space? If you are wealthy, you do that too.
Okay, true.
So, because it costs money.
So, like, low-income housing.
To get to space.
Low-income housing on Earth.
Well, but it's not low-income housing because it's nice in that world. Right, everything is extremely cheap.
I don't know if I'd want to live in space. I like gravity.
It'd be cool to live on like a planet, a separate planet.
You can invent it?
You can emulate gravity, yeah.
Terraform Mars.
You can get like Dragon Ball Z gravity chamber stuff?
More like you just rotate things
fast.
That's
true.
And you emulate the sensation, yes.
Yeah.
So,
yes, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
I mean, and on Mars, like you have 2/3 gravity, so that's equivalent enough that you're not going to have like catastrophic effects.
Yeah.
So, now if you live in low gravity environments, it starts to mess with the biological clocks, though. So, you can't do that for very long. So, sure, under those conditions, I agree with you. Under conditions where living in non-gravity affects your health, obviously you wouldn't want to fucking live in those conditions.
Yeah.
Can I run us through a thought experiment?
No. Shut up.
Because I feel like Johnny would be well suited here. If you were to kill Bitcoin today, how would you kill Bitcoin?
Ooh.
That's a good
question. So you're like a woke regulator. You know, you're in power. You have some things you can do. What would you do to kill Bitcoin?
Turn the power off for 72 hours.
The whole world?
Everywhere? Worldwide? You'd never be able to pull that off.
Very quick answer.
You'd never be able to pull that off.
Would you destroy the world in the process?
No, people would be looting the stores and stuff. But by the time everything came back online, everyone's shorting everything, and everything goes to zero.
Even Bitcoin, though?
Probably.
I feel like we're resilient to that. Like the Bitcoiners would be like, "This is our shot to shine."
Because there was just a catastrophic event that resulted in all power going off for 72 hours.
But could you individually pull that off?
Maybe? Like, how much am I being paid?
Is anybody capable of pulling that off?
Yes.
Is a better question.
Solar flare could pull that off.
Who would pull that off?
Saying you're asking an individual if they have
the capacity.
And
there's a couple of ways. Like, the thing is it requires substantial coordination. Most things that involve the use of or building of infrastructure towards a common or selfish goal require infrastructure. And to get infrastructure in place requires coordination, and coordination is extremely difficult.
And we're finding that out.
Yes.
In real time. So you're saying it's extremely hard to kill Bitcoin.
It's extremely hard to kill Bitcoin. Yeah. I also think it doesn't make any sense to kill Bitcoin. If you're a government, you should want Bitcoin to exist.
Just buy it.
Buy and hold some. It's a reserve.
Why aren't they? Who's going to be the first one to
buy it? Maybe they are.
Venezuela are.
Everybody doesn't really fully appreciate how early on all this stuff really is.
That's another thing we talked about in this class today.
I don't think you really fully appreciate how early on it is, unless you have a real good view of existing market infrastructure and then work into Bitcoin market infrastructure. And it's extremely JV.
You're telling me the exchanges are JV, bro?
I mean, we're getting close to like 1980.
I don't even think we're there yet. I mean, I think Bitcoin goes through these natural boom bust cycles, and it and it boom, and the bust starts when there's no new buyers, and it's prohibited by the infrastructure. So like we're the over at, so this happens in commodity cycles as well. It's like the price increases, it allows for an expansion of the infrastructure,
and then
when there's a bust, you make the infrastructure a lot more efficient. And so we've been going through a market infrastructure efficiency process now for about a year and a half, and like it's very, very from top of the market to now, market infrastructure is extremely better. Like
right, because you, and it's from multiple angles, right? SegWit's obviously one at the protocol level, but like. December 2017, you couldn't use Coinbase.
If
you wanted to
Bitcoin
buy and
protocol
sell.
Is almost
especially
like,
that Tuesday where they ninja launched the Bitcoin Cash.
Bitcoin protocol is almost operating as its own thing. I think you could tie price of Bitcoin to market infrastructure. Like custodians, like they're acting kind of like banks, didn't really come online for Bitcoin, which is where, in my opinion, most of the Bitcoins are going to be held.
We just got Fidelity. Yeah. Fidelity was 2 months ago
that's
in
a
beta
very,
or
that's
something?
An extremely new phenomenon. So,
they also said they're not doing Ethereum for at least 9 months, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because too confusing.
Because of their hard fork.
I think it's more reasons than that, but.
Yeah, that's definitely one.
That's
definitely one of them.
A market infrastructure now is kind of set up. It's still very much improving pretty rapidly. It's getting set up for like a next cycle, and I think we're going to continue to have these cycles. I could kind of see two pretty clearly playing out over the next 5-10 years.
Yeah, I definitely don't think the one we just went through is the last, nor the one
we're
coming.
We're definitely
up.
Not set up for governments to care about it at all. Like, nor should they. Honestly,
they're still super cocky. They're still super cocky about it. Right?
I mean, no, I don't.
It's
I don't
not
think
even
it's
on
cockiness
their radar
at all. It's talking about $65 billion of like of something.
It's a drop in the bucket.
You really should, like, if you're in their position, you shouldn't be taking it that seriously.
But they have, if they don't take it seriously now, they're fucked.
No, I don't think so. I think like you'd be setting yourself up very well if you did. In my opinion, we're all bullish here, so that's I'm not saying anything controversial. You would obviously be making a bet on something that I think will play out really well. But I like if you're living not in this world and like you really shouldn't be taking it seriously yet. Like the dominoes haven't fallen yet for you to be doing so.
I'd also argue that like due to the fact that certain nation states like the states have 12 aircraft carriers, the extent to which they care about any other monetary unit or any other asset class is just like, can you stop my 12 aircraft carriers?
Right. So that's like, why you can't have 5 nodes on the network or something. Because you
is
just
why,
like
this
an
is
air
why
strike
I don't,
them.
Like, I don't think the U.S. under any scenario is fucked. Other governments that have much worse monetary policy and controls, including their military force projection, are certainly much closer in line to being in trouble, especially during maybe the next one cycle or maybe two.
Well, especially since it looks less likely that America will crack down, right? So like once
you
have America complacent
America
with the picture.
Government is still pretty robust where, I mean, why would they?
They're better off just buying it. Like if I was just,
no,
if
I mean,
I was a politician,
the government,
I'd buy
the
some.
The government doesn't care. But if you're going to approach it from as Bitcoin is a threat, like I think the U.S. government is much more robust where there'd be a much more rounded discussion about that. They're not going to be taking any drastic actions on that side
at all. Do you think Trump owns Bitcoin?
I mean, I know his son does.
He does. He definitely owns Bitcoin.
No, I know he does, yeah.
There you go. So he basically owns Bitcoin.
Trump doesn't own anything. It's a blind trust.
Bro. It's a blind trust. Yeah. He can't see it. He can't see it.
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I'm sure he's heard of it. It'd be hard for anybody to have not heard of it at this point in time. But
I'm telling you.
I don't think people are saying it's going to come up in presidential election. Maybe Yang Gang brings it up.
Yang's going to give us $12,000 in Bitcoin every year. Well, essentially.
Yeah,
like, I'll just put it straight into my sets.
Where everybody's like so impatient of like the world, like we need hyper Bitcoinization tomorrow. It's going to be a longer process. It sounds so ridiculous to say. Like I do believe it's inevitable in a lot of ways, but it's just a lot longer than what people think.
I've been dropping the hyper from hyper Bitcoinization, just saying Bitcoinization.
No, I mean 10 years is what's your relative time frame? 10 years. 10 years for
a 10 years is a long time.
No, 10 years for dramatic change is not. I mean, like internet coming
in Bitcoin
online,
years, that's
very,
like
very,
a century.
Fast,
the iPhone came out 10 years ago. That's
so
pretty
10 years
change.
In terms of being if you're in
it was a shitty iPhone.
10 years. It depends on your time frame of things. I think because we've gotten used to tech innovation happening so quickly. that 10 years feels pretty long right now. But we're talking like tech innovation, which more impacts like social change on like a communication basis is easier to change versus like macroeconomics. Macroeconomic commerce just goes through longer cycles.
Right.
Like people, it's just, that's just how it is.
Yeah.
You're like, yeah.
No, it's, and again, it goes back to what we were talking when John was on the phone, like be the change you want to see in the world. Like do the things, the change that you want to bring in. Like,
thanks Gandhi.
Buying whole Bitcoin. I am not as skinny as Gandhi, but I do say that line every once in a while.
Gandhi would have been a Bitcoiner. It's the ultimate form of nonviolent protest.
It is.
And let's actually, talk... you know, a hunger strike is.
Best form of nonviolent protest.
Yeah, but you can't make any money from a hunger strike.
Tell that to the Gandhi family.
That's true. Fair. Yeah. Touche.
Let's shift this. You've talked to... Are we... talk about you talking to the government about this stuff?
I'm advising the SEC on like custody standards, compliance standards, and kind of market structure because of some of the work I've done in the space. They're 18 months behind where anyone thinks they are.
Yeah, so what kind of conversations are you having, or what can
they're still concerned that like no major auditing firm, like the big four, are auditing anyone's key schemas yet. To the extent that anyone is auditing anyone's key schemas. So
that's because the incentives are broken, yeah. Right? They don't want to take that risk. They don't even want to be involved. Yeah, well, think about it.
There's personal incentives for the individuals at the SEC as well, and then there's the incentives for the SEC, the institution. So those are different.
I mean, at the big four. Like, there's no incentive for the big four to even dip their fucking toe in, right?
Same, in a bilateral sense, the same kind of incentive structure exists for the people inside the big four and the institution that right. is one of them itself. So there's a lot to unpack there. The biggest problem that the SEC has right now with what they call the qualified custodianship rule for Bitcoiners is that because Bitcoin's not qualified as a security, if I deposit Bitcoin to a registered ATS or a brokerage or an exchange, and that exchange, brokerage, or ATS goes bankrupt, because Bitcoin isn't qualified as a security, it's not clear what happens in a bankruptcy court when the exchange goes to pay out its creditors or those that are, entitled to, you know, their pound of flesh from the institution. So in a classic brokerage ATS or exchange world, when I deposit my IBM shares or when I deposit my Apple shares to the institution, in the event of a bankruptcy of that institution, I get my property back because of securities law. Because Bitcoin's not a security, it's not clear that maybe a bankruptcy judge goes, nah, that goes to the top line creditors. Done, gavel. So
are we learning anything from the Mt. Gox situation?
It's more that the first real qualified custodians for the exchange of Bitcoin will just be people who use a trust structure, and then the trust will loan the Bitcoin to the exchange, brokerage, or ATS. And as a result of it being a loan to the actual performing institution, that's a security.
You'll have a claim on that.
Yes. And then that will pay back to the trust. And now the solvency chain is the trust actually doing what's required with regards to the, you know, the proper... mechanics around controlling the asset. So I think we're close to having like legitimate exchanges, like we're like actual changes, like the ISIS backed and Fidelity, where they actually qualify as a real custodian and people can actually sort of trade it with legitimate money. Versus right now, it's like how do you trade on Gemini or Coinbase? You send like a wire transfer and then just like that's it. You can't trade against your other portfolio. The asset's stuck in that one specific spot. There's a lot of mechanics that make this a lot like 1980 in normal finance. Yeah. It's like, I have a single prime brokerage. I put my money with that prime brokerage. I can only trade with people who trust the exact same prime brokerage. 1980. That's where Bitcoin is right now.
What's more important at this point, protocol development build out or infrastructure, you think? Do we still have fungibility, scalability to solve?
Scalability is... That's a long, long, long range.
I think Bitcoin works as is, right?
Yeah. I do as well.
So, I mean, both are important, but Bitcoin works as is. I think some protocol changes would have massive, great fallout as well. But I think probably infrastructure right now, if you're interested in price and adoption, mm-hmm. There's just still a major amount of friction involved for the individual, that's kind of gone away. But for institutions to get comfortable, like, they're just not comfortable. Mm-hmm. The infrastructure is JV is the best way of describing it.
Yeah.
It's been Jack
Jerry Bush League. Bush League is the best way of describing it. JV.
Everybody's been keeps getting caught off guard by price increasing, and then like we were left with the existing infrastructure. And so,
look at the 2017 run. Like, they couldn't even open accounts quick enough and verify accounts. All the exchanges were going down.
We were talking about this yesterday. This is my reason why I think the next cycle happens a lot faster than this.
Everyone says it's onboarded.
There's a good reason for that. Because we're becoming more of commodity cycles, like just larger movements. We're talking about larger mass.
But we're not really there yet.
No, I understand the reason for cycles getting longer, and I do agree with that in the long run. I think the next cycle happens a lot faster, though, because there's a lot more money that's on the sidelines.
And it's ready to go.
And then the friction for them getting involved is a massive fraction of that. There's so much friction has been removed since the last cycle.
That's what
last
I'm saying, cycle. Yeah. Yeah. And there's so many sophisticated investors that literally have their money, like their cash, just sitting there that can move into Bitcoin within a matter of hours. Like, they could just come into Bitcoin, like, super easy.
Like, the exchanges were a lot more JV, so 2016, 2017.
Look at Polo, for instance. Polo's fucking owned by Goldman now.
So if you all of a sudden got interested in Bitcoin in the beginning of 2017, it would have taken you probably, from stop to go to buying Bitcoin, it probably would have taken you like 2.5 weeks.
Like 3.5 months. Yeah. It would have taken you 3 months to get into Bitcoin.
No, if you had a connection to Coinbase or Gemini or whatever.
What kind of connection? Well, like a buddy that worked there?
You have to in order to get Bitcoin from nothing, I'm interested being in 2017 of $100,000. You need to be onboarded.
$100,000. Yeah. Coinbase, what's the limits when you first sign up for a Coinbase account?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
No, longer than that. 3 months. Like 2 months to get
But like 3 weeks.
3 weeks to get $100,000 into Bitcoin. Yeah. No Coinbase account, no network.
Nothing. About 3
bullshit.
Weeks.
Bullshit. No way. Took you way longer.
Maybe.
Either way, 3 weeks is a while. Right?
Yes, yes.
And now it's way shorter.
Now it's a matter of like hours, pretty much. You could, like, assuming you're on board, which most people are now, there's a lot of streams for being onboarded. So the flow, there's a lot of dry powder sitting on the side. Everybody's kind of playing this bottom hunting game now.
And even something like CME, it'd be super easy to get a CME.
A lot of people are onboarded. There's then the streams and routes for trading it. Everybody's kind of onboarded in different types of ways. The money flow can happen a lot faster. So this next cycle, I think, is different. Like, can't just look at it broadly. These are the metrics. The last cycle happened. Let's lengthen them out. I think the situation is a little bit different. So, and once there's some momentum, the price of Bitcoin and the demand for Bitcoin are extremely reflexive, and that's why we have these boom bust cycles.
And everybody forgets the halving.
Yeah, right. The halving.
What halving?
Yeah, exactly.
The halving's priced in though, dude.
Yeah, Ari Paul told me, Mr. $100 million man over there.
I had a question to follow up with you. And I forgot it. Go on what you were going to say.
What was I going to say?
I don't remember either.
My issue with protocol development is I don't think we're in a position.
I think Bitcoin's fine. Like, I don't think anything
I think visualize.
I'm interested to hear what John has to say about this. John, where are we? Do we need fungibility?
So there's a reflexivity between the invest in quote unquote. There's no such thing as investing in Bitcoin because it's speculation. Like, investment is a investment by definition is an expectation of somebody doing something to get a return.
Cash flow.
If we're thinking of Bitcoin as a commodity, you're just expecting the price to go up for various reasons. It's technically considered speculation. I think there's very much long term benefits from like Schnorr, Taproot, and all these things coming out.
AXIGS.
Yeah, it allows for the demand for the Bitcoin ledger to increase exponentially in ways that I don't think we completely understand yet. And then I think that's very much a long-term benefit for the security of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And this kind of feeds into like the one major concern for Bitcoin is there, with the Bitcoin having a cap supply, is the long-term is Bitcoin able to have long-term security for that? I think it, like a lot of these implementations allow for much different types of demand into Bitcoin that feed into the fee structure. Fee market,
yes.
So
Jevons paradox comes into play if these are enabled to some degree.
Well, I mean, we saw Bitcoin survives well under conditions of extremely high demand and high stress. We saw that in 2016 and 2017. Mm-hmm. So
it's even better in those situations.
Yeah, yeah. There are some longer range things that are not necessarily resolved, but they're extremely long.
Yeah, the man on your shirt was popping champagne for.
Yeah, yeah. It works. It works under stress, which is, you got to remember that's really hard for most systems to natively stress test themselves.
Right.
My worry is the counter argument people make who are not pro Bitcoin being like that was a major fail of the system, but it's if I have to like I can't get into a restaurant for 2 weeks, this restaurant has failed, right?
But this restaurant sucks, and nobody goes there.
And it's the man that got it to that point, right?
And if they charge you $10, you get in.
It's because I think people's Bitcoin is a system, and it's like the demand for it, like people have various different types of demand for it, and so if the fees go up, the people who have much higher demand for it for various reasons, they're prioritized, or like they'll need it.
And that whole auction method is kind of foreign to people, and it actually kind of speaks to the socialism capitalism argument. It makes people uncomfortable to think about the fact that I can cut you in line by paying money.
Right?
Whoa!
I'm fine with people cutting me in line as long as I pay money.
I think why, like, if you're approaching Bitcoin as like a tech platform thing, then you would think that. I think this is the case for Ethereum. This is what we wrote in our short thesis. It's very, very different than Bitcoin because Bitcoin has like the inelastic versus elastic demand part of it. Bitcoin can survive high periods of fees because it being primarily a money thing, like they're, and versus the alternatives, it will always kind of make sense.
Right, you might not want to pay $10 for a DApp, you will pay for money.
Yeah, so if Ethereum's fee market is kind of going up 10 or like extremely volatile and trying to handle a large number of contract calls or whatever, it will completely cut demand. And so if there's DApps built on it, and now DApps have the ability to port over to different smart contract platforms, they're going to be doing that. Yeah. So, and it's not, it's like, they're going to be doing that and not looking back. So it's like, you can, like, inelastic versus elastic supply. So inelastic versus elastic demand.
My fear is 2 years down the line, US government says, disclose all your addresses, tell us exactly how much Bitcoin you own. We're not ready for that. We need protocol improvements for that, right?
So from a fungibility perspective, you think that the United States government is going to demand to know all of your asset locations?
I think they're going to send us like a questionnaire that's going to be like, give us all your assets. Did you see what Canada sent out?
Canada's a socialist nation. We are not a socialist nation. So let's be clear. This nation is based on the premise of liberty and free enterprise. If those conditions change, I will no longer be an American. I would leave. Like liberty and free enterprise is what defines an American. There are other historical things that also define what it means to be an American, but that ultimately is that the enforcement of the conditions of free enterprise and liberty. If you don't have those things that exist in America anymore, it's not America anymore. Like, so you're talking about a totally different place.
This is another theme on this podcast in particular. I think we are frogs boiling in water and trending towards the socialist sort of tendencies.
I wouldn't buy the mainstream media's attempts to brainwash you about that.
No, it's not the mainstream media. I worked for the CIO, the investment fund I worked for out of college, was Dmitry Alexeyev. He came from post-Soviet Russia. He immigrated in 94. And I'll never forget a conversation we had in 2012. It revolved around the TSA in particular, but he talked about immigrating in 94 and walking to the airport and crying because of the amount of freedom he felt like the first time walking to the airport.
Yeah.
And he said, like, somebody who's coming from that perspective 20 years later, almost 18 years later, was sitting there looking me in the eyes being like, Marty, like, we're slowly but surely getting to what I ran away from in Soviet Russia, using the TSA as an example and other things. And
of course, like, the security apparatus around us has gotten substantially more sophisticated because of terrorism.
Yes.
So,
well, is the TSA even that sophisticated?
No, but there are other mechanics in play that you don't see. That's just security theater. It's a jobs program, basically. Mm-hmm. Same as with the army, almost army proper.
What is a jobs program? Socialism?
So yes, like, but again, and this is why I say we're in a race against socialism. Capitalism's in a race. It just matters who's like, does capitalism lose the lead? So I don't think it's lost the lead. So that's why I don't worry so much about getting a demand letter about all my balances. On the technical front, on the defensive mechanics for your ability to obfuscate in the event of those things, in the event of that.
As an American, you know, not as a Bitcoiner, as an American.
As an American, there are a lot of very, very interesting fungibility improvements that are happening to Bitcoin. The zero link one is pretty fascinating. The simultaneous open and close that leverages the Lightning Network, as we talked about earlier, is another fascinating one. In the longer run, I think that the mechanics of surveilling Bitcoin users, the surveillers just lose. There's too many ways for us to blow up the search set. The
heuristics.
Yeah, so, and believe me, I'm one of the first people that's right there with you, thinking that the people like chain analysis and stuff, they're kind of evil people, like what they do.
I'm fine with them, you know, it's the incentives, it sets it up. If they can do it, they're going
to
do
it,
right? Yeah, yeah,
so they're entitled to do it, but...
They can go fuck themselves, yes, but I'm fine with them.
I'm still not going to sit down and have a beer with them. All right, like right. I don't have to do that.
Right, I wouldn't.
I don't have to like the choices that person made. They have to feed their own family. Fine, do that. But that can be.
I mean, it's an inevitable thing. Like, yeah. I mean, I don't look at it as evil.
You have to build. I think it's pretty evil.
It's nuanced. At the very least, it's nuanced. But the mechanics of what happens once we have simultaneous open and close with Lightning in the middle. It makes it so that the search mechanics for any surveiller, it just blows up the search set too much. They can't do it.
So what do we need? Is this just Lightning development that needs to happen?
So,
it's
a couple of things. We need AgSigs, so aggregated signatures, which can allow us to pile into a simultaneous multi-sig for all of our...
Which is post-Schnorr, right?
That is Schnorr. Schnorr will support that. And then you need an application or series of applications that coordinates varied users in varied places to all deposit the same amount of money into Lightning at the same time using that aggregated signature. Everyone does all their Lightning shit, whatever they want to do in that time, and then you close out for the same amount to different balances. So what I just did is I made it so everyone deposits one Bitcoin, as an example, in the network at once. Say 200 people all do that at once. Everyone does all their fucking Lightning shit for a while, and then everyone settles back out to one Bitcoin again to different addresses.
What do you have, like a flag day?
It's a coordination. It's a coordination event.
It's like coin join in and out.
Yeah, so simultaneous coin join in and out for the same amounts, and then Lightning in the middle, and surveilling Lightning as it matures basically requires the same surveillance characteristics that Tor does. Mm-hmm. So you can surveil Tor if you're a majority or a plurality of the guard nodes in the network, because you can just know who you're what traffic you're relaying to where. But to do that in the Lightning Network requires that you have funds tied up in the network.
So it's like staking almost, right?
Yeah, so if the requirements for you to have strong surveillance in Bitcoin is that you have to stake a substantial amount of Bitcoin, I think we've won. Okay, like, I don't think that's...
You're going to have to buy it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier. That's an awesome incentive.
Yeah,
and so it's like a positive feedback loop.
Fine, you want to know all my balances, all my transfers, but to do so, you have to own a huge percentage of total Bitcoin. Fine. Take my relative degree of minimal privacy I as an individual have in return for making the asset literally something that you as the surveiller have to sit on.
Have you been following this Ellen Big controversy at all?
No, what's that?
Ellen Big is...
I don't even know about his...
He's like a... He seems like kind of like a darknet type of guy.
Okay.
No one knows who he is. And he makes up 60% of Lightning capacity or something like that. 70%
I did see
of
something
Lightning
about
capacity.
This. Yeah.
Okay, he can't hold that up forever.
But that could be a surveillance actor,
right?
Yes,
that's an example of a surveillance actor, yeah. Could be.
But meanwhile, he's doubling Lightning capacity in the meantime.
What I mean, it's supposed to be a slow boat. This entire thing is supposed to be a slow boat. I think because we had such rapid price appreciation, we have way more interest in the space and on the asset. I agree with Peter that it would have been better for Bitcoin's medium-term health if it had been more obfuscated for a longer period of time. But again, like the fact that we've weathered and survived the challenges that we have mean that Bitcoin was actually worth the effort in the first place. So
we could be in a lot worse situation. We're in a very good situation.
My view may be controversial within Bitcoin a little bit, but I think most people actually believe this, is that I think Lightning being used is not, we're like 8 years or more away.
It's not an unpopular opinion at all. We were just talking about this earlier.
I'm kind of pro, like, something like Cash App being like a centralized
layer two
point, like call it layer two, whatever, but it's some centralized things above Bitcoin, but Bitcoin being its own thing, and you have the ability to opt out, right? So like market infrastructure looking pretty similar to regular markets, most people using their Bitcoin in centralized ways, but the ability to opt out is what actually really gives it its value. So everybody being like service providers, you're not really stuck to them. You're not really stuck to your bank.
You can move really easily. Yeah,
the option is there.
I view it, I'm more approaching it from market's perspective, is that this is probably like how my desires and wishes on the world are relevant to how I think actually human behavior is going to play out. And that's just, I think, just such a large force. And I don't necessarily see that as a bad thing either, because I think, in my view, I think Bitcoin's value really is being a non-sovereign money thing. And as long as the protocol is really robust, that's what really gives it its value. So, yeah, I think, like, in my view, Lightning, I do see long-term that's be playing out and being very useful thing. But for, like, right now, it's almost like a proof of concept of what you could really do
with
Bitcoin protocol.
If you read BitMEX's research piece this week, like, what you have to do to be, like, a profitable routing node, it's so hands-on. It's such a hands-on process at this point, like. Normal user is not going to be able
all
to
this stuff
that.
Needs to happen.
But a normal user doesn't need to be a routing node either.
That's true. But it should be easier.
I don't think it's 8 years away.
All this stuff definitely needs to happen, but I don't see it, like, Bitcoin's value, like, it being completely dependent on this. Like, it's almost...
Lightning can fail and Bitcoin be fine.
Yeah,
the whole point, right? Yeah.
So let's talk about...
This is the problem, is that I think, like, crypto people who are outside of Bitcoin are looking at Lightning as being the saving grace of the quote-unquote scaling solution. And I think to approach the problem with that mindset doesn't really understand what this is all about, right? It's just like the Bitcoin, one Bitcoin is one Bitcoin. And if you have the ability to gain access to that, but you're still in a centralized service, that's probably like... That creates a different system than we're already in.
Yeah.
That's a different value proposition.
Let's talk to a man who created another second layer solution, Liquid.
Yeah.
So let's talk about second layer solutions, how they're being tested out, and the different the trade-offs.
When we went into Liquid and the strong federation model, the exchanges were just not, there still isn't as much coordination as we'd like between the exchanges, because you can't, when you have more liquid markets, you have healthier markets. So the settlement lag between deposits and moving between exchanges still to this day causes price discrepancy.
Slippage.
So Liquid is basically supposed to be a solution for those slippage mechanics, because I can cut the transfer time in Bitcoin down by like 98% or 99%. So in that kind of a system, or in that kind of a reality, there's just a stronger market. Like that's what the prime brokerage did when it was literally deployed in the 80s, is it enabled you to clear across a central pool of assets that everyone owned and everyone agreed to the conditions under which those assets exist. So that's just normal market evolution. The problem is that coordinating people is difficult, especially people who have selfish interests in keeping their own piece of the pie. So convincing exchanges to actually participate and to use that methodology in concert with the fact that it's reasonably sophisticated technology in the first place, it just makes for a difficult challenge. So, yeah.
Yeah, but it's a solution being tested out, and
yeah.
Lightning's being tested out. Like, what other types of second layer solutions are you excited about or paying attention to, if any?
I think Marty's Fabric, like the Eric Martindale's Fabric protocol, is pretty interesting.
He's calling it layer three.
Layer three, right? On top of Lightning.
Well, he has payment channel arrangements that you can agree to bilaterally.
I was really drunk when he explained it to me, and I only remembered like 25%.
It's cool.
In the morning.
I mean, it's cool. I'm waiting to see him again. It's like a more flexible mechanic.
It's a good bootstrapping mechanism. He's already got 100,000 users that he's sort of form fitting this on top of, right?
He has 100,000 users?
Yeah, of this game creating. Website that he has.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So
damn.
That's interesting. I think stuff like the Shift Network with Joe Weinberg and Chris over at Alchemy is pretty cool too. Like that's a where you can have second order controls over the asset. So the asset, the key management schema, is not just mandated or controlled by. It can be subject to like rules and conditions associated with, like, for example, an asset fund or an institutional or something like that. But besides that, it, like, I think that there's so much hype in the space about all the things that can be done, when everyone forgets that, like, most of the things that people are trying are just kind of stupid ideas. Like,
what do you mean by this?
It's like, it's
let's point to specific examples.
It's just this innovator's dilemma of, like, people needing to do something with their time.
Yeah, yeah. It's just like, no one needs another photo app, dude. Like, no one, like, this is the problem, is everyone wants to be their own person and have their own, like, their own story. But ultimately, most people are destined to, at best, supporting roles in other people's stories. And that's a hard...
Stop telling these hard truths.
Yeah,
man.
That's a hard...
VC culture.
Yeah, oh my God. I think Silicon Valley is destined for a hard awakening.
I think they're in the process of a hard awakening.
Well, it's for some of them, sure. But like, I actually think going to Silicon Valley and working for a Silicon Valley company is terrible for you right now.
Why do you think that?
Creates the nature and the characterization of the companies are caustic. It's not totally toxic. The risk-reward schemas are totally off-base. Not to mention the fact living in the Bay is like the most expensive place in the entire world. Psychically and your mental health, on literally just the fact that the state you live in is 62% effective taxes and the most expensive living costs associated in the entire fucking world. Like, this is not a recipe for healthy people.
Right.
And it's a recipe for...
And the buildings aren't even that tall.
The buildings... Not only the buildings aren't that tall, they're not that nice, man. And they don't build that many of them.
Yeah, what the fuck?
The first time I went to San Francisco was a couple years ago. I actually liked it a lot more than I thought of it, because I had come from the New York City bias.
First time I went to San Francisco, I got robbed.
There's definitely a New York City bias of like having some contempt for San Francisco. So when I went to San Francisco the first time, I had such low expectations that I actually liked it. And every single time I've gone back, I'm meeting my original expectations.
Well, it's worse. It gets worse every time. Yeah, I've had two San Francisco experiences. My first one was terrible. I was literally in the city for 2 hours. We went to Sonoma for wine country, and we came back to fly out of San Fran early, and we went to Golden Gate Park to go to an AIDS memorial that my wife's uncle, his name was on it. So it was a very emotional.
No, it was definitely
like,
nice.
Very emotional afternoon. It was Martin Luther King Day. There was thousands of cars parked by the park. Thousands of people walking by. And we go back to our car. Window smashed in. All of our luggage taken. It was just like, are you fucking kidding me?
Fun times. You should have practiced better OPSEC, Marty. That was your fault.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Personal responsibility.
I was a younger Bitcoiner at that point in my time. And second time I went was to interview Jack, and it was just like I walked through the Tenderloin. And it was like a zombification.
I lived in the Tenderloin for 2 years.
What was that?
Why were you walking through the Tenderloin?
I accidentally booked a hotel there one night.
I lived in the Tenderloin. I lived in the Tenderloin for 2 years. Like in the Mission for 3 years.
How expensive was the hotel there?
It was like $200 for one night.
Relatively cheap.
Yeah, New York City, whatever.
So the TL and the Mission were where I lived in the Bay, and then with Berkeley 5 years before that. The Bay's gotten worse every year. Every year I lived there for 10 years. That's why I just left.
Yeah, I know some good people there, too. I feel for them.
All the people that I know have been moving out. Very.
I don't understand why you would stay.
Everybody I know is moving to either L.A., Austin, or Miami.
Yeah, Austin's hot right now.
We got an Austin boy right here.
I know, yeah.
Austin's hot right now.
Austin, Miami, tax reasons, L.A. At least my expectations of LA were similar to San Francisco initially as well, much higher. I have a very, very good view of LA now.
I actually broached the subject of potentially moving to Texas to my wife recently, and she was like open to it. I was like, yeah.
LA can go for it.
It's awesome. I recently met Patrick Henry's great, 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 the 11th grandson, John Henry. The guy, give me liberty, give me death guy.
Really?
We hung out. It's awesome, man. Texas is amazing.
I heard there's high vibes there.
He was a good dude.
He dropped out of school in the fifth grade to support his family.
Wow.
And his older sister ended up going to Princeton. Yeah, I know. Like, and I describe him as like one of the least educated people I know, but one of the smartest people I know. Like, he has like these bits of wisdom. I was like,
oh, that's my favorite.
John Henry, like, you're on point, man. And then it's like, he doesn't know what the word articulate means.
Or are we educated?
So at the same time, it's like, it's really weird. It's like, it's a very interesting dynamic.
Well, he wasn't indoctrinated, you know?
Well, and so that's part of it. Yeah. He also has his commercial firearms license, which is nice to have.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's been nice to have you in this studio, John. In particular.
Oh, I love this place.
I've been a quiet fanboy. I think your podcast appearances over the years, particularly with Roger Ver and then on The Noted, very enlightening. I'm so pumped that you came through.
I mean, I'm just glad we got to talk about dinosaurs.
Yeah, well.
I'm as well.
Yeah. Come for the Bitcoin, stay for the dinosaurs. Anybody have like a final thought you guys want to say through that?
I mean, remember that audacity is the fuel of success. And if you actually are striving, then you're on the windswept precipice of ambition and despair.
And we're going to end it there, freaks. Peace and love.
Stay humble, stack sets.
That was awesome.
All right, I got to get out of here because I'm going to miss my flight.